This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is part one of chapter one, which contains John's commentary from his talk on April 26, 2005. Part two contains the discussion session. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
I'm approaching these comments tonight, or these remarks, these critical remarks about Christopher Columbus, this powerful, important figure in this chapter, with a great deal of trepidation, because I was born in Columbus Hospital on East 19th Street in New York City. It's now known as the Cabrini Medical Center. It was named for an Italian immigrant nun who cared for people in that area of New York City. So quite ambivalent about really trashing Columbus. But I think as historians, as scholars, students, we have to follow the evidence. This is a facility that is run by the Missionary Sisters of the Sacred Heart in New York. It's a huge, huge facility. Given what I will say about Columbus, I'm hoping, of course, that the good sisters are going to be praying for my soul, but I hope they don't pray that my soul will join others in Dante's ninth level of the Inferno. For those of you who remember, Dante had an amazing sort of structure in hell. So I guess I'm just the bearer of bad news. So with that trepidation, Columbus profoundly influenced two phenomena that transformed the modern world, especially in the Americas. One was taking land, wealth, and labor from indigenous people, leading to their near extermination in this hemisphere, in terms of some groups. And two, the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Two phenomena that so profoundly changed the history of the world, and especially the Americas. And as you recall from, because we all learned about Columbus, especially those of us in U.S. schools learned a particular view of Columbus, which I'll talk about. Columbus, of course, encountered Indians, called them Indians, the Arawak, the Taino, who had profoundly different societies than the one that he came from. They held economic resources in common. They were essentially communists with a small c. And their communal existence conflicted dramatically with the avarice and individualism of Columbus and his men, and of course the conquistadores who came after. So I think, I'm arguing as I go through Zinn's material, I'm trying to take loads of other material to add to it, that I'm arguing that essentially this was a clash, it was a cultural clash, but it was a conflict over how the means of life would be organized and distributed. Essentially privately or communally. And this is a conflict that is still with us. And in 1877, Chief Sitting Bull when he referred to the Europeans, addressed this conflict, and I quote, "The love of possession is a disease with them." He was referring to Europeans. "These people have made many rules that the rich may break, but the poor may not." Religion, of course, was intimately involved in this cultural clash, and specifically at first Catholicism, which was used by Columbus and those who followed to justify exploitation and slavery. The Protestants would be not far behind, especially in the northeastern United States, and would join in. Even Columbus's admiring biographer, Samuel Eliot Morison, a rear admiral in World War II, the preeminent biographer of Christopher Columbus, major American historian. In fact, his book, Morison and Commager, was the book I remember reading for an entire year as an undergraduate freshman at the University of Rochester. Even Morison admits that genocide occurred because of Columbus's voyages and subsequent movements of European explorers to the United States in what is now the United States. This, of course, is a word that was not used in my education all the way through high school and also as an undergraduate history major, and really was not a word that came upon the scene till I began to reread and rework some of these materials in graduate school. And I think it's a word that we were not taught to use because, in a sense, we were taught in schools and by the mass media to essentially take the victimizers and the exploiters' side, not the victims. We were taught that by teachers, by clergy, by the mass media, and of course you've read the chapter, so you know that Zinn challenges this view. These atrocities that occurred centuries ago didn't just disappear and end. They commenced with Columbus, in terms of the European and America's clash, and have continued certainly over the last century when you think of direct and indirect U.S. actions in El Salvador, in Brazil, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Haiti, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, Nicaragua, Guyana, Panama, and Cuba, among others. In fact, I don't think there's actually a nation south of the Rio Grande that the United States has not invaded or attempted to overthrow. It's an incredibly sorry record, and the record's clear, by the way. The evidence is indisputable and overwhelming. The only debate is why this has happened. The Columbus assault on the Americas was also shaped and supported by religious leaders. That is, the conquest of the Americas, who essentially lauded liberty and God and supported racism and terror. And Columbus was merely, in many ways, the first, but not the only European conqueror to use religion to rationalize conquest. It was divinely ordained by God. And since we were rarely taught to think critically about these issues, however, we did not link Columbus and the rise of Europe to religious beliefs, domination, and exploitation. In a sense, the Columbus narrative, the one we're familiar with, the one I learned in schools, and in one way or another we all learned in U.S. schools, is a struggle of two contesting views of America's past, the present and the future. And I would argue that it's difficult to confront Columbus's legacy, because not just because of our lack of critical historical knowledge, but also because in confronting Columbus, I would argue that essentially we're confronting an abusive father figure in our own home. Columbus is Columbus is the father of America or the United States, not Washington. So when we look at history, it's easy to condemn Hitler or Stalin or Idi Amin, people far away in time and place. Now, Columbus is far away in time, But essentially, when we think of Columbus, because of so many things that he represents, and so many towns and so many high schools named Columbus High School and hospitals, etc., what we're really doing is taking our critique of injustice to the kitchen table and looking across the table at this great hero. And that's hard, okay? It's very hard. Columbus, of course, is honored with a national holiday, though the national holiday is not celebrated in every state in the United States. There are states that actually have a much more resistant idea of that day, South Dakota being one of them. But Columbus is honored. When you think of national holidays, you think of four figures. You think of Columbus, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, and George Washington. Columbus, of course, is America's first great hero. So you have four American heroes honored with holidays. One was a slave trader and a conqueror. One was a slave owner and an Indian killer. You really look at George Washington's career quite carefully. One freed the slaves but did not believe in equality between the races, Lincoln. And one, Martin Luther King, was the descendant of slaves who struggled against racism, economic exploitation, and militarism, and who gave his life in that struggle. Now, despite the actual brutal historical record, which we have, I mean, we have Columbus's own logs, we have the writings of Las Casas, the missionary who was on some of these trips, who then became the Bishop of Mexico. We have eyewitness reports over hundreds of years. There's still people, mainstream people, who regard Columbus as a worthy character model. One columnist even wrote that to denigrate Columbus is to denigrate what is worthy in human history and in us all. How touching. And later, maybe I'll tell you, I got into a number of nasty situations around this Columbus thing, but we'll talk about that later. You know, you're not supposed to be against Columbus if you're Italian-American, but that's a whole other issue. Okay, in one of the books that I'll forward to you, or a name of one of the books on the reading list, it's called American Holocaust. Historian David Stannard, who's at the University of Hawaii, points out that from the first contact, pestilence and purposeful genocide destroyed American natives and drove countless numbers of ancient societies to the brink, and often over the brink, of total extermination. The ongoing violence elicited resistance from natives from the beginning. That resistance, I would argue, continues in the Americas. It's more than 500 years. And I will argue, and Stannard argues, that this violence and struggle will persist until we understand the magnitude and the causes of destruction begun with Columbus on October 12, 1492. Now, the destruction continued with other Spanish conquistadores. For example, each time the Spaniards encountered a native group, they ordered the natives to read a statement informing them of the truth of Christianity and the necessity to swear allegiance to the Pope and to the Spanish crown. If they resisted, the Spaniards stated that, quote, "with the help of God, we shall enter your country and shall make war against you and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and their highnesses. We shall take your wives and children and shall make slaves of them." And that's exactly what happened with Columbus and others. Spain finally apologized for its actions on October 12, 1992, on one of the decks of either the Nina, Pinta, or Santa Maria. Replicas of those ships had been built and sailed to the United States, and they had a ceremony in which many people of the Americas met in New York and representatives of Spain met with representatives of indigenous peoples and a number of people that I know from the American Indian program at Cornell University were on one of those ships. There was a major international conference in Ithaca, New York, the week just prior to October 12th, and then they took a bunch of people on buses to New York and had this incredibly, according to friends who were there, incredibly moving ceremony. It was 500 years too late, but it was an expression that we must live in the Americas and elsewhere in harmony with each other and, of course, with Mother Earth. To date, at least to my knowledge, the U.S. government has never formally apologized for its genocidal actions against the original Americans on what is now the continental United States and beyond. Spanish sadism was legion and openly reported in the logs of Columbus as in quotes, and in others, including De las Casas, who has documented the cruelties inflicted upon the Indians. The facts of this terror are in the public record. They're indisputable. They cannot be denied. They were Nazi-like in character, but they have never, at least in the United States, in the continental United States, they have never elicited the level of outrage used to condemn the Nazis. And I'm going to talk about that because Stannard makes a very interesting argument. He argues that the reason for the difference in the level of outrage is that our reaction to violence is often shaped by the nature of the victims, not by the crimes themselves. It's who gets killed and who gets oppressed that often shapes our outrage. Some people are more worthy of outrage than others. So that terror, the actual facts, are filtered through a belief system, a previous belief system that often does not rest on the principled objection to violence. It's a selective objection to violence. So, of course, many of us, I mean, I remember growing up, and that all we learned about was the barbaric Indians, and they did this, and they did that, and we never really understood the context. So the terror against American Indians, Native Americans, indigenous people, for example, does not warrant the outrage that many of us have felt about the horrors inflicted upon European Jews during the Holocaust. That's Stannard's argument. We learn about the Holocaust, as we should, as every person, child in this society should, to remember exactly what happened. But we learn very little, and many of us learn very little, about the Native Holocaust here in the Americas. And even within the European Holocaust, there's a ranking system of victims. We learn, again, as we should, because they were the primary victims, about Jews in Europe, but many of us learn virtually nothing about homosexuals, the mentally ill, and the Roma, gypsies, who were also targeted and destroyed by the SS and other aspects of the Third Reich. Now, what happened in the continental United States, which essentially was a genocidal attack on Native Americans, often referred to as Indian removal, was an attack on lives, on culture, on land, and even animals, such as the buffalo, millions of which were slaughtered by whites in literally an orgy of violence on the Great Plains. One of the great, you know, catastrophes facing Native Americans. So a great tragedy unfolded against those who had an intimate and sacred connection to nature, who were destroyed by those who claimed to be doing it for God and transcendent spiritual values. So the fun, and as we look at this, it seems to me that the fundamental beliefs of Christianity are central to this tragedy. They must be part our critical understanding of the role of religion and the role especially of Christianity. This was not done by Jews and Buddhists and Muslims. That must be part of any critical historical inquiry in the clash between Christian Europeans and indigenous peoples here. And in a sense, it's a clash that involves, and this is something Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's article will get into, that is, when she discusses the origin story of Ulster Scots Christians who were the settlers and colonizers of Northern Ireland, and then the Appalachians of North America. That becomes the origin story that we learn as Americans in our textbooks. And we learned about the Pilgrims especially, and again, speaking of someone who was schooled in the Northeast, we learned about the Pilgrims, the Puritans, we learned about New England. We didn't learn anything about the Spaniards in Florida and what was going on in the South, what is now the Southwest and California. So the settlers came, they did God's will, they forged the Promised Land. Of course, the Promised Land was empty, it was barren. You would read that in earlier history books. I mean, there was no one here, of course. So why not take over this place? They forged the Promised Land, and of course, they were surrounded by savages, and they had to kill the heathen. First, of course, they killed lots of Irish in what is now Northern Ireland, and then Native Americans. What happened to Native Americans in what is now the continental United States? The British actually practiced on the Irish for a few hundred years in terms of search and destroy missions, burning villages, killing people. They didn't just start it here in the United States. So you have a founding of America, in a sense, following the critical Columbus narrative, a founding of America essentially on behalf of propertied, mostly slave-owning white males who formed a settler, colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state whose genocide and confiscation of the land they essentially confiscated the land of those who were here. And Stannard and others argue that it was during the era of Jacksonian democracy in the 1820s and 30s, the early 19th century, that the unique U.S. origin myth was created, one that comes down to us in textbooks and in films and in stories that we later learned. With the initial scribe, the most important writer of this origin story, James Fenimore Cooper. Cooperstown, New York, Baseball Hall of Fame, okay, the Fenimore Cooper House. He literally invented America in The Last of the Mohegans, which a number of scholars argue becomes the official U.S. origin story. Fenimore Cooper was the great hero of Walt Whitman, who sang the song of manhood and America. And essentially, it was an America of empire. I love Whitman's poetry. He moved generations with his poetry. I actually have a wonderful, somehow my father had two cloth-bound editions of Whitman's poetry with marvelous, marvelous sketches in them. At the same time, Whitman was an enthusiastic supporter, for example, of the U.S. war against Mexico, and he followed the already established U.S. origin myth that had frontier settlers replacing native peoples, in many ways very similar, a parallel process that went on with the Afrikaner myth in South Africa. The early development of South Africa by whites and the early development in the United States by whites, very, very similar. And it created a white supremacist ideology that formed the core of U.S. policy from the origins to the present. Stannard argues that, not just Stannard, but other scholars, that Europeans conquered Americans because they waged unpremeditated biological warfare against people who were thought to be uncivilized. It wasn't just unpremeditated. There were some certainly premeditated examples. One of them, Lord Geoffrey Amherst, who had smallpox infected blankets actually given over to the Indians in what is now Massachusetts. The city of Amherst, Massachusetts is named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, as is Amherst College. And having spent time there, it's interesting, I don't recall any massive effort to change the name of the college or the town. So you have people were thought to be uncivilized and destroyed. But indigenous peoples were clearly civilized, if by that we mean having a noble religion and philosophy, original arts, stirring music, rich stories, and legend. They, of course, were civilized. And history tells us that the civilized societies that we learned about, that meant Europe, white Europeans from Northern and Western Europe, with whom we are taught to admire, are likely to resort to savage violence in their attempts to conquer primitive or uncivilized peoples. Columbus, the Spaniards, the English pacification, the conquest of the Irish, etc. It's a long and very, very tragic story. And this long history in the United States, in what is now the United States, was marked by one long war with Indians that began in the early 17th century New England in what is now Massachusetts, and essentially ended about 300 years later with the 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, when some 350 unarmed Lakota, mostly women, children, and old men, were killed. Among the prominent citizens supporting and even advocating genocide against Native Americans, and this absolutely blew my mind when I discovered this in research, was none other than L. Frank Baum, the author of the much beloved Wizard of Oz, who grew up in Chittenango, New York, not far from where I used to live. He moved out to South Dakota. He was editor of the Aberdeen Pioneer at the time of Wounded Knee. Before the massacre, he stated that, quote, "The nobility of the redskin is extinguished, and what few are left are a pack of whining curs who lick the hand that smites them. The whites, by law of conquest, by civilization, are masters of the American continent, and the best safety of the frontier settlements will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians." After the massacre, Baum wrote that, quote, "We had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up and wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth." Now, I'm still a fan of, that movie. I don't know how many times I've seen it with my kids when they were growing up. But wow, I keep asking, where was the Good Witch of the West when the Lakota needed her? Incredible. And there's a little plaque. There's a little plaque to L. Frank Baum when you drive into Chittenango, New York, near Syracuse, not far from Syracuse. And I wonder what the kids at the local high school learn about Baum. This long, tragic tale, beginning with Columbus and the Caribbean, of course, comes across the United States and comes here to California. The Spaniards remarked that when they came to California, what is now California, they found Indian societies with remarkably egalitarian and democratically ordered cultures. The explorers described the Santa Barbara or Channel Islands in the mid-1500s with many Indians who greeted them in friendship and treated with ceremonies of peace, which of course, as with the Taino that Columbus met, whom he described as the most amazing, gentle, beautiful people, this interaction, of course then he went on to kill them and enslave them, these interactions ought to really cause us to question sort of this socio-biologistic notion of human nature that people are inherently evil and violent, because you got two people coming together and one group was actually quite wonderful, gentle, and beautiful, and the other group wasn't. So if this is a genetic thing, somebody had some genetic problems here. We're talking about a socialized culture. In California, as elsewhere, of course, in the United States, disease and cruelty took a huge toll among the Indians, and part of it, tragically, and again this gets us back to religion, was the result of brutal conditions in Jesuit and Franciscan missions in this state that are all over the state. I mean, we can still visit them. The Franciscans starved and worked their would-be converts to death, while the diseases they and others had imported killed off thousands more, similar to the slave labor camps that the Spaniards ran in Central and South America. With the best theological intentions, I mean, it's always done for people's good, okay? The Franciscans eliminated Indians with the effectiveness of Nazis operating concentration camps, as the missions along the coast of California might best be described as picturesque charnel houses. It was the mission experience that truly decimated the Indians of California. They were strictly regimented and disciplined in these missions and essentially became slaves. The legend, of course, and again, think of films, think of what we learned, is that the missionaries, the Franciscans, etc., were gentle and mild. And some, of course, were, who really believed in what would be, let's say, a generous or a general understanding of what people, when they think of Jesus, you know, people ask, actually a question that ought to be asked a lot about people today, you know, would Jesus be running this kind of camp for Indians here in this mission? So there were some, of course, who were gentle and mild, but the historical record, again, we have the records, because we're talking into the mid-19th century here. The record reveals brutal conditions and harsh punishments. And of course, in the process, the holdings for the Franciscans were quite extensive, ending up owning thousands of Indians, cattle, horses, and sheep, having huge estates. At the time of the American conquest of California and the development of California as a state, one scholar argues there were about 72,000 Native Americans left out of perhaps 300,000 who were here when the Spaniards first came. By 1865, this number dropped to 15,000. We have to remember that those white settlers who came to California, were gold or otherwise, had two centuries of Indian warfare behind them, and they did embark on an effort to exterminate Indian culture and lives, not transform it, in a sense, as the Spanish actually expected to do. And after the establishment of California as a state, raids on Indians by whites killed at least 15,000 people in two decades. And of course, there are other sordid activities. U.S. citizens followed the Spanish custom of kidnapping Indian children. Thousands were taken and apprenticed to various employees, and the old Spanish custom of raping squaws became an established Yankee practice. So in California and across the country, therefore, for roughly four centuries, Europeans and white Americans, white U.S. citizens, engaged in an unbroken string of genocidal campaigns against the native people of the Americas. And I would argue that what Holocaust survivor, writer, and Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel asserted about the Nazis and the Holocaust in Europe is relevant to our understanding of what happened in America, and that is the absolutely central role of religion. And I quote him, "All the killers," he's speaking now about the Holocaust in Europe, "all the killers were Christian. The Nazi system was the consequence of a movement of ideas and followed a strict logic. It did not arise in a void and had its roots deep in a tradition. This was inseparable from the past of Christian civilized Europe. So therefore, to understand what happened in what is now the United States, what was inflicted on native peoples who were here, who had their own contradictions and their own violence and struggles and wars between various tribes or nations. We're not romanticizing what went on here, but we're talking about the fundamental clash of Europeans with those who were already here. It is necessary to examine the core of European thought and culture, especially Christianity. To many European Christians, the Indians were thought to be barbarians. In the original Greek, barbarophonoi, those whose speech sounded like barbar to the Greeks. Those who could not speak Greek were barbarians. That's where the word comes to us from, by the way. So the racist attacks against these barbarians emerges from the same roots, number of scholars argue, standard among them, that these attacks here in what is now the United States, California, upstate New York, where I used to live, Michigan, Illinois, I mean, just go through the states, by the way, that have Indian names, okay? Massachusetts, Connecticut, Ohio, etc. That the roots that created and that these attacks, racist attacks, emerged from the same roots that created and nourished attacks against Jews in medieval Europe. That anti-Semitism and racism against native peoples are but two sides of the same coin. A belief in the inherent superiority and inferiority of groups of people not subject to change and given to us by some divine providence. Now, anti-Semitism in Europe, must be recalled, was advocated by some of the great religious leaders that we read about, that we learned to admire because of their challenge to the Catholic Church, none other than Martin Luther. Remember Martin Luther, the 95 Theses, he banged on the door, he challenged Catholicism, etc. We've all studied the Protestant Reformation, Protestantism, a protest, right? Well, who knew Martin Luther was an absolute virulent anti-Semite, okay? I mean, he would have been right at home in the SS in the 1940s. He called Jews a plague, a pestilence, useless, evil, pernicious people, tricky serpents, assassins, and children of the devil, among other things, and mad dogs. And he urged violence against them, including the burning of synagogues. So a number of scholars argue that as with Jews in the Middle Ages, Europeans dehumanized and demonized American Indians in the process of exterminating them. And that, because we can't undo history, we must now try to understand why and how this happened and how the lies and mystification about history based in our schooling and the mass media have blocked our critical awareness of what actually went on so that we can understand and reject what has really been a generation after generation of lies and distortions. Now, the racist views of American Indians were put forth by eminent historians, okay? We're not talking about just, you know, someone they just pick off the street, some guy who, you know, has certain prejudices. We're talking about eminent historians, dominant historians, who referred to native territories as empty space, wilderness, vast chaos, unopened land, virgin land. I mentioned Samuel Eliot Morison. Arguably the most famous historian in the first half of the United States in the 20th century and our admiring biographer of Columbus. He dismissed Native Americans as pagans expecting short and brutish lives, void of any hope for the future. They were Stone Age savages. Therefore, the assault on these supposedly uncivilized people came, for example, this assault on supposedly uncivilized people came despite a social life, for example, among Eastern Europeans, especially the Iroquois Confederacy, that attracted the admiration of some European observers. Scholars point out that the Iroquois League, in what is now upstate New York in Canada, and I lived in Ithaca, New York, and there are a number of little historical markers around Ithaca. A number of them were General Sullivan in 1779 during our Revolutionary War, and direct orders from General George Washington came through and destroyed virtually every Cayuga Nation village because the Cayuga was sympathetic with the British. Okay, they even burned down fields and trees in Aurora, New York. It's about 30 miles north of Ithaca. It's called Peach Town. Okay, thousands of Cayuga died. I never learned that until some time ago. Well, some ideas out of the Iroquois League were directly or indirectly responsible for things like the public meeting tradition, free speech, democracy, and a number of things that actually got attached to the Bill of Rights. And a strong argument has been made that some of the ideas influenced the founding fathers about constitutional principles, especially in the earlier Articles of Confederation. But the Iroquois social life was much too radical for even the most advanced framers of the Constitution. The United States did not have full women's suffrage until 1920, although it was fundamental to the Iroquois Confederacy. There was an equality between men and women that did not exist in the United States. We still have capital punishment, which the Iroquois Confederacy had simply abolished. And the concern for child welfare among the Iroquois Confederacy and other American Indian nations that was very prominent did not really arise in the United States until the 20th century. So these were the savages and the uncivilized people. So in essence, what we've learned, and it's hard actually to find the words given 500 years of destruction, and first you destroy a people, then you have to tell stories, and of course the winners tell the stories, and it's the stories that now we're left with that we need to struggle with. What essentially Zinn is telling us in this book, and what others have argued, is that we've really learned a Eurocentric, well, especially a male Eurocentric view of America. As one geographic historian says, a set of beliefs about reality that educated and usually unprejudiced Europeans and European Americans accept as proposition supported by the fact. But we have to ask, how is it that Eurocentric historical statements which are not valid? Because I would argue that any systematic, scholarly study of the history since Columbus landed here, in which you follow the facts, or in many cases follow the money, but you follow the facts where the facts lead you, and if the facts interfere with our preconceived prejudices and stereotypes, then we have a decision, you know, a decision of conscience. Are we going to follow what the facts tell us, or are we going to follow what we would like to believe and continue in our denial? So in a sense, we have learned to follow Eurocentric historical statements that are not valid, not confirmed by evidence, and sometimes contradicted by evidence. Yet they continue to survive as accepted beliefs for generations and even centuries, over and over. They're reproduced, and it's not that, especially in terms for those of us who have been involved with the educational system, it's not that people are, you know, getting up with an evil intention, but it's reflected in, I worked with more than 6,000 students, mainly in a program of teacher education at a college in New York, and out of those 6,000, maybe 1,200, 1,500 were teachers who had to get their master's degree, and very, very, very few had a critical understanding of the kinds of things we're talking about here. I mean, I had to go back after graduate school and as a professor to relearn a lot of these things. So it's not that they were trying to do a trip on their students. They simply were not given the critical tools to understand these issues so they could help their young students think critically about these issues. So Zinn is challenging every major assumption about Columbus and Eurocentrism. That is, essentially, he is challenging the colonizer's model of the world. This is the model we've been taught, and we've been taught this model, I believe, and I argue that he's arguing this, so that we will ultimately support the oppressors and not the oppressed. Because as Zinn says, in the inevitable taking of sides in history, you have to, by the way, take a side. Okay? There's no such thing as being neutral in history. Being neutral is a place. Being in the middle of an argument is taking a position. And as the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire argued many years ago, in the struggle between the powerful and the powerless, to be neutral is to side with the powerful. Always. So that in the inevitable taking of sides, and Zinn takes sides, okay? There's no doubt about that. Okay? Of course he's taking a side. Everyone who writes about history, sociology, injustice, justice, whatever, takes a side. But in the inevitable taking of sides, he's arguing that if we accept the dominant view uncritically and do not challenge it, we essentially become mute and passive in the face of injustice. And that's the essence of the argument in the first chapter. So let's take 5-10 minutes, stretch, relax, take a break, and then let's open it up for your thoughts. Thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano comment on Chapter 1 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. This was Part 1, and Part 2 contains the discussion session. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.